So I noticed you just finished eating a banana.
Yes, I did eat a banana.
I like to make it very visual. You know, it's a radio show. People don't have to see your face, but I like to keep them kind of in touch with what we're doing inside the studio, especially your food choices.
Yeah, today is better than, you know,
was most it pork rinds?
Pork, yeah, crackling.
Crackling. Is that the correct term for it?
It is. It's really? The skin with the fat still attached.
Now, is that more of like a... was it onomatopoeia? Is that the word where it's like buzz and zap?
No. Onomatopoeia is like... Oh, yeah, no, it is.
It is, right? Do you think crackling is like an onomatopoeia where it's like, it's called that because if it was like frying in a pan?
I think it is.
Okay, interesting.
And that's what's happening, you know, as your arteries swell up. They're crackling.
Interesting. Yeah. Heart. It's the sound of heart disease. Absolutely. But I noticed you weren't eating a protein cookie.
I was not.
Because you're not a piece of shit. I cannot stand the inundation of like... Like, just go out and get fucking Oreos, all right? There's probably, an equal macronutrient ratio of one. I don't know of a protein edible thing that has more protein than either fat or carbs. Like, I don't know of one where protein is the predominating macronutrient.
So you're saying if you want protein, cookies should not be your first choice.
Exactly. Like, that's the way I diet, it's very binary. Like, if I'm on... It's egg whites, avocado, like it's on.
Yeah.
If I'm off, it's type 2 diabetes.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's like, you know
what?
It's
poor crackling.
And for me, it's like, I can't stand people that just walk the line. It's like, just stop being mediocre. And if you want to be mediocre, that's fine. But don't try and sell me on that you're like some sort of badass, hardcore, dedicated, like just have a fucking Snickers and then go eat a chicken breast. Like make it one or the other. Cause it's every day with the shit. It's like the bars and the cookies and then people using like protein powder as like a condiment on shit. And it's just like enough.
I'm going to disagree and I'm going to stick with my protein milkshakes.
So you do...
I'm absolutely kidding.
Because that's another thing that gets me too is like I've written up diets like for clients and it's like they say they follow it to the letter and you know, me and you partake in protein shakes, but people do it with milk and they have a hard time with water and it's like, dude, you're throwing back like an extra like 300-400 calories a day in just milk.
That's my diet plan. I want those extra calories.
You do protein shakes and milk?
Oh, hell yeah. Whole milk.
No shit.
Yeah, dude. At the same time though, like... I'm 175 pounds soaking wet. Like I'm trying to put on some weight.
I gotcha.
But a tactic I use to make myself feel better is I won't ride the line. I'll just have a fucking milkshake.
Yeah.
But when I tell it to people, I'll tell them. I'll just add the word protein.
Yeah, that's
you
what
know.
They
there's
do.
Protein in that milkshake. I had a protein milkshake. I had a protein cheeseburger and fries. From
like,
Five Guys.
Seriously, like all you need to do is like sprinkle some kale in there, and you'd be healthy.
Yeah.
Okay. Episode 10.
Episode 10, RX Radio, ladies and gentlemen.
Dr. Jordan Genta, Dr. Jordan Shallow.
That is us.
DC. Now, today we're going over squatting.
Yes.
Under the microscope.
Squatting.
Yeah. So this was a request after our deadlift episode.
Yeah.
So we sort of went over the deadlift in detail, contrasted how we utilize it in both powerlifting, CrossFit, different techniques, different variables. So we're going to sort of take a microscopic look at squatting today. Yeah. Do you want to lead us off?
Yeah. Also, shout out to Corey Mail. Hey. I know we talked a little bit about this, so here you go.
This one's for you, man.
This one's for you. Yeah, so different utilizations between, well, similar utilizations, just different styles of squats that both of us use. Correct me if I'm wrong, predominantly in powerlifting, you use a low bar squat.
Yeah.
That's the,
yeah.
You know,
from
the way you move the most weight.
Yeah.
Right. More so... In CrossFit, the chosen style of squatting, just for the transferability, which we spoke on before, is a high bar squat.
Okay.
More upright torso. You want to be able to transfer that leg strength to something that's going to be more similar to, you know, a clean or an overhead squat, a snatch.
So funny. So like similar to the deadlift, the end of the deadlift wasn't the main objective, right? Like you need a deadlift to perhaps get this bar over your head. You also need to deadlift heavy, just as you need to squat heavy.
Yes.
But there is a potential dynamic correspondence to a move that could be more challenging later on in the movement.
Yes, absolutely.
Before we get into that...
Mm-hmm.
I think we should highlight common mistakes. So common mistakes. Non-competitive, just regular gym goer. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the most common mistake, form-wise or otherwise, for squatting?
I think it's just the misconception of the squat in general of what you're doing in this movement.
Yeah.
Right? If you're squatting, whether it's in powerlifting, whether it's in CrossFit, Olympic lifting, you should be training that whole range of motion, right? You shouldn't be squatting to 90 degrees with your shins parallel.
Right. That's that NASM squat.
That's exactly what I'm getting
at. You want to clarify? Because we mentioned that in the past.
Yes. So what we're saying is basically the way squats are traditionally taught in most personal training and most, you know, physical education settings are that feet are flat on the ground, shins are vertical, push the hips back.
Toes forward.
Toes pointing forward. And, you know, basically what's happening is a lot of extension in that lower back, that lumbar spine, that lumbosacral junction. And you're not going to be able to move any substantial amount of weight in that position. You're not training full range of motion. Even if you do train that way, you're actually probably going to be losing range of motion in those hips and in those ankles and stressing out different parts of your body, because it's not structurally the way we should be moving. We should be moving straight up and down within that frontal plane, right? We want that combined center of gravity right over the center of the foot. And a lot of things are going forward and backward, and we're essentially all of our weight is behind that, where we need it
to
be.
I think the biggest problem with the NASM squat is that it negates any rotation in the hips. I think that's where the whole squat lives and dies for me, is like, is it's just you're folding, they have them fold within sort of that that flexion, sagittal extension. Plane.
Nothing
else. I mean, your knees and your ankles, I mean, your ankles have more mobility than that, but the knees, which is ironic because that's the one thing they're avoiding to load, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're loading the body through like global flexion extension. But the one joint that would be most responsible for that in the squat is the knees, but they're shooting the hips so far back as to avoid knee flexion extension at all. And it also, like, for me, the pelvic mechanics don't make sense, because they all start with like that anteroverting of the pelvis, that pelvic tilt, right?
Arching
shooting your butt back.
Yeah.
Which, for, I mean, shit, we both got diplomas on our walls that we need to pay off sometime in like our grandkids' lifetime. And so far, that's been huge from a business standpoint.
So like, by all means, keep squatting like that. Here's my card.
If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, like, don't listen to this at all and keep doing your thing. But like for me, when I see that anteroversion of the pelvis, the first thing they do is sit back into the heels, pelvis tucks forward. So the pelvis, I guess, for like the uninitiated, is three bones, essentially, right? You have like an innominate bone on either side that houses your hip sockets. And then you have a sacrum down the middle, which is an extension of your spine. Right. So in gait cycle, I guess it'd be a good place to start on the mechanics, is like if you take a step forward with your right leg, the innominate bone, the housing of your hip, of your femur, goes back, right, into rotation as the hip flexes forward. So that innominate relative to the rest of the pelvis goes into, I guess like you'd say, extension, which is the opposite of where the NASM squat will start you, right? That puts you in like a flexed pelvis position, an anteroverted position. So if you think about that, if my right pelvis is in like a posterior tilt or an extended position setting for a flexed trajectory for the hip as we take a step forward, the opposite hip, the left hip, would be doing the opposite, obviously, right? So that would be in that anteroverted position. That innominate would be tilted in a way that most people who squat the NASM style would be cueing both of their pelvis, but that's putting a hip into extension, right? So what the NASM squat does is positions your pelvis in a way that would be continuous with extension of the hips and then asks you to flex through that position. Then you need to think, well, what's happening at the SI joints, where both of those innominates meet the sacrum. If the sacrum is a part of the spine and you're trying to not fall on your face and you're shearing both innominate bones counterintuitive to the way we're supposed to move, that's sprained SI joints. I just hear money when I see people squat like that. It's just business card when you get up after your workout, after your coach like helps you up off the ground, come help me pay off my student loans. Like that's what I see. That's what I hear when I see that kind of squatting, because it's so counterintuitive. And the biggest thing is, well, it's bad for your knees, right? Squatting's bad for your knees, which is in my experience, couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah. I mean, I squat a decent amount away from my size. I mean, nothing to the proportion of you. I don't even use knee sleeves.
Yeah.
I very rarely will I use anything around my knees to, you know, any equipment. My knees feel fine.
And I think a lot of it comes from just bad research.
Yeah.
Right?
The human knee joint can support about 7 times your body weight.
Really?
7 times. Yeah. Huh. Can you squat 7 times your body weight?
I'm working on it.
Working on it, but,
not
but are you
this,
there
not
yet?
In this. I don't think, I don't think that is.
I don't think that's humanly possible.
Like a 7 times body weight total is pretty good.
Yeah.
So like between three other lifts. Yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't know it was that much.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose with running, right? Like the amount of force you generate with running.
Yeah, a lot of force.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure on that. It's what exerts more force on the knee. Would it be something like that? Running, jumping, or squatting? Because squatting, you're stationary.
Yeah.
You're creating the force through your muscles, through loading those quadriceps in the knees.
Well, I mean, for me, the knee study, it all goes back to, I think it's like 50s, 1956. There was a study of this guy, Carl Klein. I think, and his initials were actually KKK.
We've touched on Carl Klein before.
Like big red flag out of the gate. If this you know, knee Nazi is telling you that squatting's bad for knees. And basically the study was he took lifters, post-competition Olympic lifters, who were just in the deepest knee flex squat position possible, like catching a snatch or catching a clean.
Yeah. Maximal at that if it's competition.
Exactly. And then tested their valgus and varus force. So how much their knee permeated, was able to permeate inward and outward with applied force from like a practitioner. And basically had this like, this little degree measuring stick goniometer thing that he made. And the inner exam reliability was none. It was just like different people applying different forces and measuring how much that knee moved from side to side. So how much the tibia could go inward or outward on the femur post-competition. Mm-hmm. And then compared that to just, you know, Joe Blow off the street. Hey, man, you got a minute? Let me test your knee with this homemade thing that we made. And that was stuck in science. That's been there for, 60 years.
Yeah.
And I think people can still, once it's in research, the bias will always be there. So the responsibility of people.
Do you know the conclusion of that study?
Are you asking me like personally?
What did he come to from that study?
So they made a false equivalency. I mean, obviously the laxity of the knee was greater in the post-competition lifters, right? You could probably extrapolate out and say the laxity of an untrained individual off the street after putting them through a workout would be greater than the post-competition lifters because they have... they have strength built in, stability built in.
Well, even at that, if you take someone off the street right now that's never done a squat in their life, they're probably going to have pretty rigid knees, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to you take someone like me or you who trains that full range of motion every day, we're going to have a lot more flexibility in that position, right? So
I think they just made a false equivalency.
Yeah.
I think there's nowhere that says like medial, like there's an internal logical consistency to like, you know, common knee injuries. So like the medial triad of like a valgus. So like if you know any girls that played soccer growing up, you know a girl who's torn her ACL, torn her MCL, torn her medial meniscus, right? Yeah. Kicking across, kicking another girl with that increased Q angle from the hip and then everything goes on the inside of the knee. But so I think from that mechanism of injury, they've sort of extrapolated out a little too far and said, okay, if this is lax, then it's unstable, then it's more likely to be injured. Not realizing that squatting isn't like two girls kicking a soccer ball. It's very controlled. Yeah, it's very, especially at the level that these competitors were doing it.
Absolutely.
So I think that false equivalency was just, it was, wasn't founded, and they've done the study over and over again.
Yeah.
And there's no reproducibility. There's no predictive factor as that degree of measure being something that you can hang your hat on as far as predicting injury, right?
Yeah, so there's no correlation with
no injury. Exactly. No correlation. And not only was there no correlation then, he took that lack of correlation and then inputted causation. Okay. So I think that's a big thing that people like overlook a lot in when examining and appraising research. And I don't know if this is something we covered in the research episode, but appraising research, we'll have to look at the difference between causation and correlation, right? There was that study with like coffee drinkers
and lung cancer.
And lung cancer, right? Yes. So it's like, you know, if you're going to go out and hack a dart and it's cold outside, you're going to have a cup of coffee. So there's a correlation between drinking coffee and lung cancer, but there's not a causation, right?
So it's just simply that smokers drink coffee.
Yeah.
Commonly, right?
Yeah.
That could be that's another correlation. but
yeah, it's not causation.
Extrapolating from that.
Exactly. So I think
so it's a couple steps removed.
Exactly. So but I mean the squat has been shown, I mean not obviously disproven to not be good for to be bad for your knees, but also measuring lower body strength as a sign of longevity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Again, causation, correlation, there's a difference. It's correlated to longevity, but there's been some research on building lower body strength being more important than
the ABC study.
The ABC,
It just had to do with elderly. I think it was populations in their 70s. There was a correlation between increased leg strength and mobility and longevity, right? Yeah. So the more leg strength that you can maintain at that older age, as you age, you're going to be more functional. You're going to have a higher quality of life, right? And that's, you know, to take it one step further. So right now we're in our mid-20s, right? We're squatting a decent amount of weight. You squat 7 bills. I'm a little bit less than that.
Don't jinx it. But, 694.
But so say you just stop squatting
right
now for the rest of your life. 50 years from now,
You're
still probably going to have more leg strength than someone that in your age could squat maybe their body weight.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to deteriorate a lot more on someone with a less maximal squat at this point in their life than it will someone you that squats a ton of weight at this point in your life. Right?
And the interesting thing with the study, so I got it here. It's Oxford Journal of Gerontology, 2006 it was published. And the correlation that they compared, I mean, there was a lot to it. It was a longitudinal study over time, that the strength component was more important for a longevity standpoint than muscle mass or body composition. Mm-hmm. So like men's physique guys, take note. You might be shredded, but you know, if I see you throwing on the knee wraps for like a 315 leg press, sorry, dude, you gonna die.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, which was interesting because I think there's with the vanity that comes with working out.
Yeah.
The idea of relative strength gets lost in a lot of like commercial avenues. Like people go to the gym to look good. So people would rather sit on a leg extension and catch a quad pump than put a bar on their back. But the quad extension isn't a measure of lower body strength, where they were able to show that increasing strength, not sub body or like a muscle mass or body composition, was actually more favorable to longevity.
Yeah, so strength would more so be weight lifted per unit body weight, right?
Yeah.
That'd be a proportionate weight measure.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't mean that, you know, I have to squat as much as you, but proportionately, if I can squat as much as you per body weight, which still probably not, but then I'm in pretty good shape with that lower body strength, right?
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good place to call it on like broad spectrum general fitness enthusiast squatting. Now I kind of want to go down a few roads as far as like very narrow looks at how you approach the squat, your most difficult variations, progressions, everything from sort of the hardware and the software, belts, shoes, bar position. I mean, so your hardest would be the overhead.
Yes.
Right. That is the hardest.
That is the hardest variation.
That is the hardest thing in life ever. That's like, that's like dividing by pi in your head. It's just, it's impossible. So walk me through it from like a cueing. Where do you start with someone? They walk in the gym, fresh to CrossFit, you know, no real strength, stability, mobility, endurance background. Where do you start with someone with the overhead squat? That being the precipice of your squatting movements.
Right. So it's always a progression. I'll start. That's the first thing I teach someone when they walk in these doors are the squat series.
Yes.
So starting with just a normal body weight squat, move your body the best way you can. Mm-hmm. And what that teaches is unloaded lower body squatting mechanics.
Question for you.
Yes.
And I had somewhat of like, not an argument. I was fairly diplomatic. Online with someone the other day where we were talking about principles of injury.
Was it a troll?
It wasn't. So it was, I forget the guy's name, Josh Rustin.
So an intelligent human.
No, so it was a physical therapist. Yeah, Josh works with Christian Thibodeau and he put up a thing about injury prevention.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, we talked about this before. One of my principles is if you can't get into a movement unloaded, don't load it.
Yes.
How do you work that with someone new? Because I know like the counterbalance squat is something you'll use.
Yeah.
Do you consider that a load? Like, will you make sure they can sit kind of like ass to grass with no external stimulus first? Because me and this guy had this little back and forth on this.
give or take, I will. I like to load people a little bit.
Okay.
To just see what breaks down.
Okay.
But starting place for me, ground zero is always just an unloaded bodyweight squat.
Yeah.
So I can first assess mobility and movement patterns.
Okay.
Sometimes you'll have people that are so deconditioned that they have no glute medius, their fucking knees are touching when they're squatting.
Yeah, really?
Right? Well, I mean, that's an exaggeration.
Sure.
But I'll see things where if I were to put, you know, 50 pounds on that person's back, everything would break down to the point where they may have an injury.
Okay.
So that's the first thing, is to assess strengths and weaknesses.
Mm.
First of all, can they maintain good lower body position while squatting? That's always the first thing. Can you, in CrossFit, we, like I said, we have standards to all of our movements.
Yeah.
Can you start at full hip and knee extension, lower yourself to a below parallel squat, which is considered with the hip crease below the top of the knee.
Yeah, yeah.
So that thigh's sloping downward. Yeah. And then stand back to full extension while keeping good knee, ankle, hip alignment.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, that's not a criteria as far as good squat. The knee, hip, and ankle. That is a junta, like, you know, sundown CrossFit criteria, because we're not trying to, like, snap people into the ER. But in competition, the relative knee, ankle, and, I mean, the hip crease below the plane of the knee, the knees up, it's sort of depth.
Yeah, so the only standard is start full extension, hip and knee, get below parallel, get back there.
Because I've seen some, like, Bambi, bow-legged, inward, like, knock knees. And, you know what, in competition, if you're at a high level and you're going for a PR, something's got to break down, sure. I just didn't know if that was a set criteria, if they were calling no lift on that.
No, okay. So I mean, that'd be fantastic if it was, but the standards are pretty independent of good movement.
Okay.
Right? They're just dictating the range of motion.
Squat to depth, that's all.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just so we make sure that every single person that comes in this door is moving through the same range of motion.
Yeah.
Now, my job on top of that is to make sure they're moving through that range of motion well.
Yeah.
So like I said, the progression to an overhead squat, step one is going to be assess mobility and a little bit of lower body stability by making sure that they can do an unweighted bodyweight squat, keeping that lower body in good position.
So even with the progression of the overhead squat, you just test like a normal neutral shoulder position squat first.
Absolutely. And then, so that's, I wouldn't even go that far.
Okay.
Bodyweight squat is more so for me to just assess the waist down.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you can do a successful bodyweight squat without hurting yourself, even if your spine's in shitty position.
Sure.
Right? You're not going to hurt yourself because you're not loading your spine.
Gotcha.
Obviously, you don't want to train that way because that's what you're going to revert to under fatigue. But the next step for me is a front-loaded squat.
Okay.
So typically a front squat, which will assess not only the lower position and lower body position. And at this point, I'm just loading with a PVC pipe just to see movement pattern, not movement pattern under load. But I'll progress to a front squat with a PVC pipe. And that shows me a couple things. That shows me, okay, you have the lower body mechanics. Can you keep your spine neutral and in a stable position while doing that? That's the number one thing it shows me. And the second thing would be shoulder mobility.
Okay.
Can you get into a front rack position?
Okay.
Which I know a lot of times you'll see at, you know, 24-hour fitness, maybe even at your gym, people do that genie bro, rack.
It's called the bro rack.
The bro rack, whatever you want
to
call it.
It's a testament to your fully developed deltoids.
Okay.
I look at it as a bad, no. I totally agree. I think, I mean, because of the loads we use in front squatting, and I think this is something we can speak on later as far as relative percentages of front squat
to back squat.
Because we use the front squat to build the deadlift, generating upper back strength and active thoracic extension without having a bar leveraging on your back, using your sort of hands to press against it to stay stable.
Yeah.
So when we're trying to load heavy.
Yeah. So that's for more so spinal bracing for you.
Spinal bracing. Yeah. Thoracic, like upper thoracic extension, which has a really good dynamic correspondence over to deadlifting.
Right.
But I do think there is a merit. And it's more so as like a predictor of injury. Like I won't be as strong in like a proper front rack position, but I have adequate active external rotation of the shoulder to get that elbow inside the plane of the wrist.
Right.
And I think that has a great carryover to my low bar position, but also my bench press, my overhead movements. Like I think it's a really good litmus test out of the gate for someone. So I like that you guys use that as almost like a gatekeeper progression before that shoulder is full flexion overhead with a PVC
button. Yeah, it's just kind of a gauge to see where they're at with that shoulder mobility.
Yeah.
And in, you know, you have to think also, we're training the front squat more so as an Olympic lifter.
Oh, true. Yeah.
As to clean a bar from the ground and put it over your head. So with those arms crossed on your chest, you're never, how are you going to get that bar over your head, right? So you need to be in a
really aggressive front raise. Just the, it's all delts, bro. It's all delts. Just snap it up there.
That's it. That's it.
Okay, see, it's funny like how obvious that is now, that it, but it didn't even register in my head that bars go there. Like, that's as high as it goes. It's on my rib cage. What else do you want from it? Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So that's, you know, just that back to that transferability, but back to the actual progression we're talking about, the squat, front load squat, counterbalance, however you want to do that. But for me right now, we're at a front squat with a PVC pipe, so I can assess, are you able to keep good spinal position with appropriate shoulder mobility to keep that bar? So at this point, we're not talking about center of gravity anymore. We're talking about combined center of gravity.
Okay.
Because you have a bar in the equation now. Yeah. It's not just where's your center of gravity. Yeah. It's where's the balance point between your center of gravity and the center of gravity of that bar.
You are one thing.
Yes,
you
exactly.
You're a unit.
Exactly. So anytime that bar comes forward, so we're talking about, we'll say the front of the ankle. Right?
Yeah.
That's about usually, your center of gravity.
Yeah.
Anytime that bar shifts 1, 2, 3 degrees in front of that, it's going to feel exponentially heavier and it's going to pull you off of balance where you're most powerful, right?
And to the tune of how far overhead that bar is, right? Like, I can get away with it because, I mean, I almost look at it like a tire iron, right? So think of like taking a tire off your car.
Right.
Exactly. If there's still men out there that know how to do that. I have a AAA card. I don't know what I'm talking about. But it's like, right? So you're the long tire iron.
Exactly. Right? The longer that arm is, the less force you're going to have to do to take that.
So where like the bar for me rests like rear delt, probably a good, I mean, depending on arm length, like a couple of feet lower.
Right.
So I can get away with a deviation of a degree or two and not be able to. Granted, that's equilibrated a little bit by the amount of load.
Right.
I don't know many people overhead squatting close to 700 pounds, but I think, I mean, I think the theory behind that or the logic behind that is fairly transferable where it's like,
right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's same idea. It just gets magnified more and more as we get, and I'll build on this, but I'm still on the front squat now. So I'm not even talking about overhead. I know.
Okay, all right.
It's
a buckle up.
Yeah. You should feel sorry for the people to take this intro class with me. But, so we're assessing the ability to keep that combined center of gravity in line with your body's natural center of gravity, right? So you're basically choking yourself out with the barbell.
Sure.
Can you stay in good position? Yeah. Then from there, I'll progress to overhead, which believe it or not, people actually, I've seen people struggle with the front squat that actually have an easier time with an overhead squat.
Now, do you think that's because the cueing then becomes more intuitive? Like I've loaded people in a front squat where it's like when you load a front squat, to go into the NASM model of shooting your hips back is like people will still try and do it because it's like, I mean, it puts even more so extension on the lower back. The center of gravity is already pretty much loaded. You have to break in the knees first if you want to stay upright. But I've seen people like at lower loads, like pretty much revert into the NASM squat, excessive relative shoulder flexion, and they make it happen.
Yeah.
But do you think the, I mean, because it seems counterintuitive that people have an easier time once they're overhead. But do you think that ease is coming from there's no way in hell you're going to load that overhead and then sink into your NASM squat, right? Because the magnitude of...
Exactly. So you get that instant feedback.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's when you feel that bar pull you off center.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Do I have dental? Do I have dental? Am I gonna eat this fucking floor right now?
And dude, that's the funniest thing. I call it, when people do a front squat, like you just described, I call it the front rack good morning.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
And I want to fight them when they do it. But I mean, a general rule, as much of your body as you can get under that bar, the better it's going to feel.
Sure.
So if you're doing a front squat and you're looking at the ground, the only thing between that bar on the ground is your wrists.
Yeah,
probably gonna fuck something up.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Right, if you can get your shoulders under that bar, your hips under your shoulders, you're in a lot better shape.
Plie, drive the knees out, exactly. That kind of thing. I got
so, you. So back to what I was saying though, as you start to load overhead, that you know, as we touched on, that tire iron, that lever gets longer.
Yeah.
So, our relative center of gravity is gonna always be our hips, right? Yeah. That's, you know, the center of our body, but our hips aren't really what's connecting us to the ground. It's our feet, right? Yeah. So we have to keep those hips balanced over the feet.
Sure.
But either way, you take something as far as you can get it away from that, that's going to be an arm's reach overhead, right? So you're taking something as far as you can over your body center of gravity, trying to still keep that in line with your body center of gravity. So that combined center of gravity, we still have to keep in the same exact place while really enforcing the first thing, you know, out of the gate that you just straight up can't do this if you don't have the mobility to get your arms overhead and get into a full squat.
Oh, it's amazing how people, I don't know how people get dressed in the morning. Some of these dudes, it's like, do you is there a zipper somewhere?
How do you get your shirt on?
Right? It blows me away.
No. And people say this is like an unnatural range of motion. No, it's fucking not. You should be able to reach over your head.
Yeah.
You know, you're born with the ability to get your arms over your head. Fucking keep it.
Dude, I've had elderly clients where I've asked them, like, when is the last time they've put their arms over their heads?
Yeah.
Years, decades. Like, think about that. Like, just imagine, like not walking for like you have the function, you have the ability, you have the biomechanics and the muscle laid down in place. And it's been years before they, since they've had even their arm over their head. And it's just like, if you don't use it, you lose it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100%. Anyways, I'm just wrapping up here, but the idea now is that we have something as far away from our center of gravity or our center of balance or connection to the earth as we can get it, and we have to squat. So the number one factor here is stability.
Yeah.
Stability in the sense that we have to be able to first get ourselves into these positions, and second, we want no movement that's not controlled.
Sure.
So stability in my book for a lot of this stuff is what I define it as is the ability to prevent movement.
Yeah, resist movement. Absolutely. Right? Yeah,
resist movement.
Totally agree.
So overhead, you need to have, first of all, wrist position, elbow position, shoulder. You know, you have 30-some vertebra. There's three joints between the top and the bottom of each of those vertebra. That's 100 joints right there, right?
Ooh, I feel like I should know this. Yeah, 37? Is it 37 vertebra? Come on.
7, 12, 5.
Oh, fuck math. Come on, dude. Really? Are we counting the sacrums? Anyway, regardless.
We won't even count the fused vertebra. But
we're editing this out.
Yeah, for sure. But that's, you know, there's close to 100 joints in your spine alone that you have to resist movement in.
Yeah.
And then from that, hips, knees, ankles.
Yeah.
So literally every major joint in your body, you are resisting movement in.
Yeah.
And you're controlling the movement in the hips, knees, ankles.
Gotcha.
So you have to basically not move from above the hip and have flawless movement below the hips for this thing to work out perfectly. So that's the series of progression. And when I teach this, I will teach it usually with a 15 to 35 pound barbell after I go through it with the PVC pipe.
Right.
So you're using some weight to get, like we talked about, that instant feedback.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not enough weight that, you know, if anything goes wrong, just, you know, throw that barbell, get away from it. And you're going to live.
I got you. Okay.
So that is, you know, in a not so small nutshell, the progression from someone that walks in the door, never squatted before, to an overhead squat in my eyes. Okay. Why don't we put it back on you? The what most powerlifters use will be a low bar squat.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me how you get someone there?
Yeah. So, I mean, really similar. Like, I will always start like, either, I mean, unloaded just to see how they move and how they cue more so. Like, a lot of form issues are just, it's just a lack of information. It's a lack of knowledge, right? Like, they had a personal trainer at 24 Hour Fitness that told them to do an anti-SAM squat. So it's like, I'm not really quick to judge when people walk in, because if they've been training for a little bit, and they have some sort of like kinematic proprioceptive awareness, a sense of their body's ability to move in space, a couple of verbal cues will get them really far out of the gate. It's just they've never been introduced to them. So, I mean, body weight squat. Sometimes I'll do like individual range of motion assessments of more global range of motion of the hip. I mean, I spoke on this before about one of my principles of injury prevention is there's a difference between a exercise's range of motion and a joint's range of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Something that an overhead squat pretty much takes into consideration anyways, which the amount of dynamics behind it. With the low bar squat, trying to be as mechanically efficient as possible. And then this is an old school sort of facet of powerlifting that's just like, you need to be as mobile as you have to be to get depth. Basically, like, your mobility should stop at parallel. Yeah. Like, just enough so, like, three white lights on the platform and you're good.
Right.
Which I think, to me, is just outside that threshold of range of motion. There's an injury just sitting there waiting for you, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So I might do, like, individual gross assessments of, like, the hip's ability to move into extension and rotation and stuff like that as a way to predict injury down the road. But, I mean, if all that's clear, body weight squat. Now, with low bar, it's a wider stance, and I'll speak on a little bit later about how that can be a detriment if it's the only kind of squatting you do.
Yeah.
So I'll progress front to back loading, similar to what you do, like a counterbalance, like a goblet. So start with body weight, like a goblet, a counterbalance squat with a kettlebell, light, keeping the load, I mean, relatively benign. If they got to drop it, they drop it. So decreasing like any risk of pain or any aversion to loading the movement itself. And then, so I'll go goblet, front, like proper front rack is an assessment of shoulder mobility I know more people that can't squat because their elbows and can't squat because their hips, knees, and low back, period. More power. Because the amount of active external rotation, scapular retraction and depression you're going to need to get your hand, I mean, high bar is easy. You just kind of tuck the elbow underneath. It's resting on your traps, right? But yeah. To get into a low bar position from a shoulder standpoint, thoracic extension, you know, how mm-hmm. strong are your, like your mid traps and rhomboids and an ability to pull those scaps back to set that trajectory for that rotation. Because if you're not going to get rotation of the glenohumeral joint or the ball and socket of the shoulder, you're going to get it at the elbow, which is meant to hinge, right?
So yeah, it's going to be a weak link in the chain.
Exactly.
Stressing it out.
And man, that is, and just the way like powerlifting is set up, we squat first. So the guys can get through it because you don't really need your elbows to squat. You got bench waiting for you. You got three attempts of your heaviest bench presses after you've just been like torquing the shit out of your elbows under hundreds of pounds. And that's where the whole thing falls apart, right?
Yeah.
So for me, I'll use the front rack position on the front squat as a litmus test of shoulder mobility, of can you get into an effective front rack to indicate to me that you have enough active, not only thoracic extension, but active external rotation. The big thing with powerlifters is the strength relatively is there, but it's the inhibition of the anterior structures of the shoulder that really slows them down. It's a very internally, I mean, pecs, lats are pretty much where the upper body lives and dies, right?
Yeah.
Knuckle draggers, like their thumbs are pointing behind them with so much internal rotation. So right. You can strengthen lower traps until the cows come home, but if you're not releasing some of those anterior structures, then, I mean, you're going nowhere as far as like doing an effective, safe, low bar position over time. Like it's not a longevity play. So goblet, front rack, high bar. Now the high bar is good because it now the bar is on their back, but we're trying to break them of that sitting back, right? We talked about it before, like basically the malleolus, the ankle, the mm-hmm. center of gravity lies just above that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'll do is I'll take the side of the bar, so like the circle bit at the end of the bar, and point to that and point to their foot and videotape straight line.
Plumb line,
exactly. Yeah.
Gravity pulls straight down always.
You know what? OG of the fitness guru game, Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
Shout out Isaac Newton because he is the one tried and true guy in the fitness game. Yeah, bench with your lats, bench with your pecs. There's a lot of contentious issues. I think we can all agree that gravity's pulling that fucker straight to the ground.
Every time. So
with me, it's like once I point out like, hey, if this is here, like if this end of the bar is here and your ankle, your medial lateral malleolus is here, this is how much unnecessary horizontal movement you have to equate for.
Exactly.
That in a movement that should otherwise be completely vertical. Yeah.
It's all about efficiency, right?
Exactly.
Fastest way from point A to point B,
straight line every right? time. So if work is a measure of force times distance, you do more efficient work by not having to equate for any unnecessary travel in a horizontal plane. So
mm-hmm.
I'll use that to teach them to initiate with their knees, not first, but at the same time as their hips. That's the thing with powerlifting. Heavy weights, you'll see the guys that, you can see the cues in real time. If they go knees forward and then sit back, knees forward, hips back,
yeah.
Like under enough weight, it's just like very clunky. And then that in itself becomes inefficient. So trying to use the high bar squat to get them comfortable loading into the quads first and then sitting back when needed. And then from there, as you progress to low bar, I'll also progress the stance width, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'll squat out of a monolift for this meet. which is like you just stand up and you squat. You don't have to walk out.
Right.
So in my warm-ups, the mono, like I'll walk out, you know, first couple hundred pounds, but as you start getting up there, I'll start using the mono of its function. And so I can just stand up with the weight and squat.
Mm-hmm.
As I move further into the workout and closer to my top sets, I'll actually drop the position of the mono as my working weights get lower. Because I'm starting in a wider hip position.
Okay.
For me, it's something that it's like, I don't like hitting all my warm-ups because it's aggressive. Like my knees are still over my toes. I mean, I have pretty good hip mobility. My knees are still over my toes at that bottom. My hips are strong enough that they can keep that position to create a very linear, very vertical leg drive.
Right.
But I'm trying to make sure that I have to travel as less distance as I can. I'm still hitting depth, still going below parallel, plenty below parallel. But for me, it's like I don't want to be torquing my hips under the load of 100, 200, 300, 400, 500,
mm-hmm.
600. And then now I have to load up the heaviest. I want to keep, I mean, I'll make sure before I even get under a bar that my mobility is far exceeds anything that I'm going to need under the bar. So I increase that threshold, in my mind, decreasing that likelihood of injury.
Yeah.
But as the weights get heavier, then the stance starts to widen. I don't want any more undue stress, time under tension on the, because I mean, what you're sacrificing in, what you're gaining in efficiency, you're sacrificing in sort of like aberrant biomechanics. Like it's not normal to squat that wide. Yeah, you don't walk around a third world country and see like little Asian kids playing craps on the sidewalk in like a fucking wide stance, low bar position, right?
Right.
You're tucked in. Because this, I mean, this for me is a big one that I've been running into a lot, is the relationship between the VMO, it's like that teardrop muscle on the inside of your knee, and your glute med.
Mm-hmm.
So when we lock out our squats, because we're wider, we're not locking out the knee in terminal extension. We're locking out the hips. We're using the glute max to finish the rep, and we're relying on the structural stability, like an A-frame ladder. When I finish a rep, my hips are loaded in a way where, I mean, based on foot position will dictate how much torque you're getting from your hips. So how much of that stability in that top position is coming from active glute med, glute max, external rotation that you can torque into the hips. So you'll see guys like fully fucking like duck footed.
Oh yeah.
That's all structural stability. That's punch your ticket, snap City Express. Oh, yeah. And but for them, it's like because they're exploited by the fact that they don't have enough strength actively. Everyone has the structural stability. They turn themselves into an A-frame ladder,
right?
Where if they were to start in a more internally rotated, not toes forward, but relatively forward compared to their super flared out hip position, they'd be able to generate torque. So what I'll tell guys that are going too wide or don't have the glute strength, lower the weight, bring the feet in, but put the knees out.
Yeah.
That's going to be an expression.
Train those glutes, right?
Exactly, an expression. Because what happens is when we're not finishing the rep with the knees, like some of these Olympic lifter guys, like, you know, the Asian, very like shallow hip socket encapsulation, long femoral necks, like can dive bomb a squat. Mm-hmm. Toes together.
Oh yeah.
Like, I mean, I got white dude caveman genetics. Like I need a bit of width to get there, but the relationship, I mean, getting back to my point, the relationship between the VMO and the glute med, as far as think of like when you're running, right? If I'm, I mean, so I've been told, I don't really run, but like if I'm propelling myself forward, so my right leg is my stance leg, that glute's got to bring me to a position laterally stabilizing the pelvis, and in doing so, the knee, where I can fully express the strength of my quad to propel myself forward,
right?
So that's one thing that CrossFitters, if you look at like CrossFitters or Olympic lifters from like, say like 6 inches above the knee, and they're wearing their little like Reebok shorts and they're kind of tight. Sure. And it's like, you're like, oh, bro, that guy works out. That's a nice VMO. Well, if you look at some of the strongest fucking guys in the world, powerlifters, the VMO down to the floor, because we don't need calves to powerlift. That's why I'm wearing pants. And it's just like, it's almost non-existent because that terminal extension isn't loaded.
Yeah.
They finish the rep with the hips, not with the quads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that over time predisposes a lot of powerlifters to a lot of knee instability issues because they're finishing with the glute max. They're not loading the glute med. They're not torquing in the hips. They're using the structural stability of a super wide external rotated or externally rotated hip position with no active stability, all structural. Yeah. And now you're lacking sort of the medial stability that the VMO provides at the knee because you're not loading it. And you're also lacking any lateral stability of the glute med activation because you're not torquing, you're not using it at all. So you're requiring purely on structural stability. And then right outside that threshold is going to be not just an injury, an irreparable injury, like a surgically repaired injury where it's like, think about your shoulder, right? Your shoulder is all functional stability. You know, I know plenty of guys, shit, I torn labrum, torn rotator cuff, no surgery, fine. Because there's a tensile strength you can call upon on the muscles that attach to tendons that attach to bones. But if you, and with a knee, it's all ligaments, right? Just little ropes that go from one to the other. So if you don't have the active stability from the hip or from the VMO, and you damage not a tendon, but a ligament, ACL, PCL, MCL, LCL.
Yeah. There's no compensation. Yeah.
I'll see you in 6 to 8 weeks. We'll start your physical therapy and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Right. We'll regain passive range of motion because you're going to need fucking surgery.
Yeah.
So I sort of went off on a tangent there, but I think that's a really common thing that's overlooked because guys get so fixated. Well, that's a competition lift. I got to get better at that. I practice that only. And so they go down this road and it's like, dude, if you're not front squatting, if you're not loading that VMO in terminal extension, because it is that last 30 degrees when the VMO is most active, but it's also, if you're ass to grass in a third world squat, it's that initiation of the movement from a fully flexed position. Then your intermediates, then your lateralis, then your rec fem take over. But to finish it, so it's like right at the beginning of the movement if you're bearing a narrow stand squat, and right at the end of a movement if you're loaded in a neutral hip position.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is like a huge thing I implement from the get-go. Like, hey, on the platform, absolutely wide stance, be as efficient as possible. In training, variability within your squat stances, variability within your loading patterns, safety bar squat, front squat, goblet squat, single leg stuff. How many people don't load? You're only as strong as the sum of your parts. I know guys that can squat 700 pounds. I can't stand on one fucking leg.
Yeah.
Like if you told them to put their shoe on tying up, they'd just fall on their face. So, I mean, yeah, that was sort of a long answer to a short question, but I wanted to talk now about breathing. And I wanted to go back and forth on this with you because it's something you got to do.
You got
to. But the thing is, it's a lot easier for us to do it than for you, because we don't have a metabolic component to our squatting.
Yes.
Now, I want to hear your answer first before I go into mine, because mine's kind of a little bit more what I'm assuming to be benign and compared to yours, because I'm never short of breath. I never go up to a bar and like I'm winded, because he gonna do one where it's like, you, how do you equate for breathing in, say, like a lighter load, higher volume?
Right. I've done, well, I mean, it depends on the type of squat, but it's all very similar. I've done workouts where I've done, this is something you've probably never done, but a back squat from starting with the bar on the ground. Or
how the fuck?
Yeah. It's fucking crazy, right?
What? How does that even happen?
You do this thing where you deadlift the bar really quickly and get it on your shoulders.
Oh, okay. You're going to be an asshole about it. I know what like a fucking clean is. No. Like,
no, but
I'm thinking you're like crawling underneath the bar or something. I don't know.
I've seen it. I've seen that on Instagram from, I think, some of those movement specialists.
Oh, yeah. No. Get your spinal alignment specialist.
No. So, yes, I think what you think is pretty crazy isn't much different from something you've probably experienced before.
Okay.
So when you do volume squats, what, in the 6 to 8 rep range, do you ever get?
I go a little further. I mean, I come from more of like a hypertrophy focused background, athletic background. So, I mean, when I've reintroduced squats post competition, you'll see me under 15, 20 reps.
15, 20?
Yeah. Yes. And I'll do it in a way where it's like loaded, like I'll do 405, drop to 315, drop to 225, drop to 135. And that'll be like 20, 25 total reps. I won't just go
straight. I'm talking one set though. You're talking one set?
Well, I'm sorry, drop set. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll go like 4 or 5.
Think of a set where, you know, maybe a moderate load, but you're doing 15 to 20 reps.
Okay.
Think about how you feel about 12 to 16 reps into that set.
Yeah.
Very similar to, you know, the same stuff that I'm talking about right now. So obviously, we want controlled diaphragm breathing.
Mm.
That's, I think that's something that alone in the sport of CrossFit is something by less experienced people is very overlooked, is sure. using the muscle and ligaments that we have that are meant to expand and contract our lungs
yeah.
to actually do that.
Funny that.
Yeah. A lot of people get caught up in that hyperventilation, chest neck, breathing. Chest breathing. Yeah. yeah, where they're just, you know, sucking in air.
Mm.
No, it's not going to do anything for your core stability. So you want to fill those lungs with air. Big, deep diaphragm breath in. You're going to hold that breath, increase that intrathoracic, intra-abdominal pressure.
Yeah.
As you're descending in the squat,
yeah.
then as you hit the bottom, you're exploding up and you're giving it a good inhale abdominal contraction on the way up.
Inhale, exhale.
Exhale. Exhale right. abdominal contraction. Okay, yeah, sorry
about I gotcha. That.
On the way up. And then it's just going to be the same pattern every time.
Okay.
I'll see people hold their breath while squatting. Not a good idea.
Yeah, no.
Never a good idea.
Yeah. Start seeing when your vision starts looking like an old home movie.
Oh, and
you're
dude,
just like just white there. Lines, narrow field of vision.
Have you ever passed out squatting?
Last night it was close.
I
put my head through a window.
That
was close. Yeah. I so, wasn't out, but close enough.
Yeah, I've gone limp. I've never actually lost consciousness
yeah.
from front squatting.
Yeah,
you know. Just doing a lot of weight, trying to keep that bar in
on
line with my center of gravity.
Yeah,
right in that carotid sinus. Your brain thinks that you're just dying, so it shuts off. But breathing is extremely important, especially when you have to do. I've done, you know, not too long ago, there was a workout that CrossFit put out, 100 overhead squats.
Assholes.
100 overhead Sadist. Squats with an empty barbell, though.
Oh.
So I did a set of 100 squats with a barbell over my head. So you think I wasn't breathing every single rep there?
Do you, question for you, and this will tie back into how I utilize breathing. Every time you're squatting, do you have a belt on?
No.
Okay, interesting.
No. So yeah, we talked about this a little bit in the deadlift episode. CrossFit for the masses, these people should not be dependent on a belt.
Sure.
The idea here is we're building core strength
yeah.
so that when you're, I don't know, moving from your apartment, you have a yeah. box of fucking books. You
yeah.
think if people still read, I
don't
know.
Think so.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably not. So a box is something else
yeah.
that's heavy.
Porno mags.
yeah.
right, that's probably out too, right?
Yeah.
God,
yeah.
we're so old. That's so weird.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe a box of old iPhones.
Yeah. In the Silicon Valley, that's probably what it is. Yeah.
so that's what it is. But that box... Whatever the hell is in that box, it's heavy,
yeah.
right? You think they're going to go in their gym bag, grab their weight belt, or are they just going to pick it up?
I've done it before.
You've done it?
Well, it's funny.
So you're leaps and bounds.
Well, no. It was a Halloween party, and there was this girl that was really drunk, and I was like Bane, of course, because like what else are you going to be as a meathead? And part of the costume was like, he's got sort of like a belty thing, and it's like I didn't have like, I just have a beater and like some shorts and the fucking altitude training mask or whatever the hell. And this girl was so drunk that like I had to carry her up 4 flights of stairs. And I was like, well, I got the belt here. I might as well belt up a little bit.
There you go.
And just over the shoulder she went. And that was all good. But anyways.
Yeah. So smart life decision.
Yeah.
But most people would not make that decision or even have the thought process to make that decision.
Yeah.
So the idea here is most people that walk in this door from 6 in the morning to 8 at night.
Yeah.
I want those people to learn to brace their core, stabilize their spine on their own. So
gotcha.
No, during a Metcon, a workout, shit like that.
Metabolic.
Unless we're going for heavy squats, something over probably
80%. Yeah.
In my opinion, no, you should not be using a belt. You should be using your muscles to brace your spine.
Yeah. So the reason I brought it up, and because we're frequently working over 80%, and I think for us it's the dynamic correspondence of training with that implement on, even at lighter percentages, because when the weight gets heavy, you don't want to have something... not constricting, but something sort of a different stimulus. What I like to do is teach people how to breathe with the belt as a tactile cue. So breathing into the belt is a really common cue you'll hear in powerlifting because the belt is around your stomach. You have to diaphragm breathe to breathe into a belt. It's just inevitability. And then that circumferential pressure dispersing that inner abdominal pressure all the way around helps stabilize the low back as a consequence. But I think over time it's or like in the initial stages it's better. I mean, if the powerlifting is the vein they're going into,
right.
I'm not averse to throwing in a belt in because I think the carryover from teaching them how to breathe with the diaphragm with that tactile cue all the time, it's basically like someone poking you every set and saying like, hey, breathe in your stomach, breathe in your stomach, breathe in your stomach. So I like it from that position. I also think so this is a big thing with powerlifting because it's so much weight that the consequence of deviating one way or the other and like any unnecessary movement is it can have such a detriment to the efficiency and therefore the success of your lift. You'll see a lot of people even when they breathe into their stomach, they elevate the rib cage, which I went back and forth on for the longest time. Where, because when you do that, the bar starts to move, right? Up and down. And now you have like this wobbly 100-pound bar on your back. And it's like that can kind of throw you off. So the idea that they breathe in so deep in their stomach that the rib cage elevates, which I used to be keep the rib cage down and breathe into it. Like I'm breathing in. You guys can't see this, but it's like you can see what I mean, where it's like you only breathe into the volume that your rib cage is allowed without the rib cage elevating. Mm-hmm. But what I've started to do, and I want your opinion on this, is so Boyle's law. So Boyle's law is basically a relationship between pressure and volume in a closed circuit, right? So think of your body being the closed circuit, pressure being the amount of air you can bring in, but the volume is how much you can expand. I can expand my, like if I were to say, take the deepest breath in possible, everyone would do the same thing. They would elevate the rib cage, the low back would arch, and that's where they would breathe into. So right. I avoided that for the longest time, but I've really found a good success with being able to control the extension of the lower back as I elevate the rib cage, because that increases my volume, right? If I can breathe, elevate the rib cage with a bar on my back, but then before I start my rep, tuck the rib cage down, and not only tuck the rib cage down, but tuck the pelvis underneath to set the trajectory for flexion. I'm basically taking the most volume I can and squishing it down from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. There's one guy, this guy named Ben Pollock. He's a powerlifter. He does like, did 198. I think he may have took a run at a record. You watch this guy, he's shredded. So it helps, like you can literally visually see him, how he breathes. And I think he's one of the best breathers in powerlifting. If you guys look him up, and he's like PhD deadlift, Instagram. I don't know why we have names anymore, right? Like when we have kids, God forbid we ever have fucking kids. It's like, okay, yeah, exactly. And this is, what do you want to call it? Okay, at little Junta daughter. Okay, all right, that's what it's going to be. And that's just going to be your name. But if you watch him breathe, and I think he does something similar where it's like really not increase the extension, but increase the amount of volume and then, you know, let the bar settle, then tuck the rib cage down, then bring the pelvis into the position that's going to cue that efficient sort of safe initiation of the squat. And now you're a movable object and an unstoppable force. Now you're locked in.
Right.
So that's, and for me, how I look at breathing. And it's something that has sort of, it's changed, because I used to just be like, breathe into the belly, don't let anything else move, try and be as efficient as possible. But I think with the bigger weights, I think that's sort of helped me progress a little bit. But I think there's a principle of diminishing returns past a certain point. So, I mean, I'm going to drop powerlifting names here because it's cool when people do that. Guy JP Price, super handsome lifter. He described to me at a meet, he did like 936. He described to me like the sensation of having like 900 pounds on your back. He says you open up your mouth and you can't breathe. Body, like it's like your body knows that it's like a balloon that has a hole in it. And it's like, if you open your mouth, air is just going to come out because you have 900 pounds on your ribs. That's forcing air out of your lungs. So I think past a certain point, I don't know if we'll ever get to 900 pounds, but I think with some of the big guys, it's like, they'll take a breath in before they even get the bar off the rack. Cause that's it. That's the end of the line. That's, if you want air, that's where you're going to get it. Cause when you take a step back, you're not getting shit.
Yeah.
Moving on from that. And it's not really a natural segue. Footwear, hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the belt sort of led into this. Now, how do you guys, you're not like triathletes where you're switching up from like bikes, but you guys do so many different like events in a sense. Like how do you go into a workout? Like, so the open's today. Open starts today.
Yep.
Now, is there ever been a time where you've had the time within a workout to switch to your ollie shoes? Or like, if you had to climb rope and do like snatches.
Yeah.
Ollie shoes? Climb the rope with the ollie shoes?
First thing I'll say is CrossFitters fucking love equipment.
Powerlifting is the same, dude.
But aside from that, the high level CrossFitters, they will train in their flats. So whatever shoes you work out in, that's it.
Yeah.
There's some give and take with that. The majority, like I personally can speak from my experience only, but, and what I see, but I can hit close to 100% my snatch, close to 100% my clean and jerk. I've never tried a high-end squat. I really like squatting in all these shoes. Yeah. I'll always do that because you're never going to have a 400-pound back squat in a workout. But I can hit pretty damn close to my 100% my ollie lifts in my, you know, my Nikes.
Is that something you factor into your training?
Yes, absolutely. Do you vary that? Okay. I've lately over the past year, I've taken a little bit more of a focused approach on my weightlifting because weightlifting as a sport is very different than weightlifting in CrossFit.
Sure.
So I train weightlifting as weightlifting.
Yeah.
And then I also train weightlifting as CrossFit.
Okay.
And I treat those as two different disciplines.
Okay.
So if I'm weightlifting,
shoes are on.
Ollie shoes are on.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll use
shirt is tucked into the sweatpants.
Yes. Yeah, shirt
fanny pack. Actually, it's just a t-shirt
with a singlet bottom.
That's so uncomfortable. There's nothing worse than a guy in a change room that puts his shirt on first.
Oh, dude.
Have you seen these guys? Oh, just nothing.
It's not a good look.
Like, just lock him up now because we know he's a pedophile.
Yeah, you have to be over a certain age, like 40 plus probably, with very unproportionate amounts of really dark body hair.
Yeah.
For that look to be an option.
Yeah.
And then if it is an option, you should, probably turn yourself into the police.
You basically, if you walk into a change room, it looks like, have you ever seen the old Batman movies where Danny DeVito plays the Penguin?
Danny DeVito.
It's like, that's what it looks like. Like, everyone who does it looks like the bad guy from Despicable Me. That's what it looks like. I mean, an odd reference to go from Batman to Despicable Me.
All right. It's getting weird. Back to the
naked old man. Yeah.
I don't even know what we're talking about. But yes, so I will train my weightlifting, as a weightlifter would.
Okay.
I will train my CrossFit weightlifting. So I've done workouts before where it's, handstand push-ups, double unders, and heavy clean and jerks, right? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
You're going through these different movements, you're not going to change your shoes if, you're trying. Every second counts in your CrossFit workout. If you spend a minute changing your shoes, you're not going to do great, right? So you better just be able to lift that bar.
Mm.
So I will train heavier barbells in workouts like that in my regular shoes.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it's not very much of a difference for me.
Yeah.
If I have, because it's a very different feel lifting a barbell with a high heart rate, your focus is very skewed compared to if I were to lift that same barbell, low heart rate for one rep.
Yeah.
Right. So if I'm lifting for one rep, I want everything to feel good as I'm getting into that position.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make it as perfect as I can.
Yeah.
If it's in the middle of a workout, nothing's going to feel good. I'm going to feel like I'm dying and this weight's going to feel like that 900 pounds on my back, even if it's only 250 pounds. But the idea is I don't have time to worry about that shit.
Yeah.
Right. I need to trust in my training, trust in my abilities that I can do this in my regular.
So shoes. Tonight, first one of the Open.
Yes.
Am I looking at what you're wearing? Is that going to, are you going to be,
that'll
the one?
Be it. Yeah.
You're marching into battle in those bad boys.
Yep. That's so, it.
Now, okay. Then now this is I think a good segue for once, because you come at weightlifting and squatting from the two different, let's call it disciplines, from an Olympic lifting background, efficiencies sort of on the forefront of your mind. Mm-hmm. You got the ollie shoes on. It's controlled. It's, it's not, let's say when you're training for weightlifting, it's not so much for time or speed.
Right.
Flip side of that,
mm-hmm.
squatting for CrossFit, more so for time and speed. How do you factor in? Because I think this is going to be a really interesting contrast, and this is something I get questioned on a lot.
Yeah.
Let's call it tempo, but more so descent and ascent. I'm not too worried about, I don't know of a federation or a sport that calls a actual up command. So basically how quickly you descend and how quickly you ascend when training for each. Because that's the big thing with CrossFit, right? Like, they get shit on because it's like you take these complex dynamic movements and you do them not for weight control. Not that it's not controlled, especially at the level you do it at, but you do it for speed, time, and repetitions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you factor in descent, ascent, tempo in training versus in the Open in competition? Yeah.
So in Open, in competition, suicide pace, kill yourself, do it as fast as you can.
Okay.
In training is how you prepare so you can do that. You want to do it as fast as you can while being able to control that, while you want to do it as fast as you can well.
Okay.
Right? So you want to be able to keep that bar balanced over the same exact spot. And what you're doing in training is training to be able to do that quicker and very controlled. So,
but your fastest reps are in competition. Do you find give another or take. Gear?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Intensity is when I'm competing against other humans. So the open is one thing. It's an online competition. Yeah. So you have to bring the intensity from within. It's a very internal motivation. But at regionals, when I know that I'm competing with some of the best athletes
and
in the world.
And they're next to you.
And they're right next to you. Yeah. I can literally see what they're doing. Fucker. I'm moving faster than you. Like, I'm not going to fucking slow down. Okay. I'm going to die before I slow down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if this barbell falls on my head because I'm overhead squatting
too fast.
This
workout was brought to you by the letter Y for YOLO.
Yeah. But you train at that intensity or as close to you can as you can get to that intensity. Gotcha. So you have the trust in your abilities that you can do this squat faster than he can and still maintain control.
So you're not way. So descent speed, ascent speed, only pace, suicide pace. Today feels like a good day.
I don't want to give that advice to the masses.
No. But for you, that's
for
your
me,
thought
process. That's it. I'm going to go as fast as I can without dying.
Because I mean, I want to flip that because I get every time I put a squat video up.
Oh,
on
dude.
It, everyone is like, it's been called like the slowest descent into hell. This dude, Winston from Australia, like basically was like, that is like, for me, so there's, I think it's either Delta Force or Navy SEALs. And you know more of these guys than I do. There's a saying called slow, that goes slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yeah.
That is my, that is my thought process when I descend into a squat. Because, I mean, I see guys that are just fucking reckless under a barbell that just like you can see their last will and testament in their eyes, but they take a breath in and you can literally almost hear their brain go, love you mom, and then they just fucking just go for it, like they just dive bomb it and like whatever happens. And I mean, granted, these are some of the stronger, I don't want to say better as a measure of quality, but stronger as a measure of overall strength, stronger lifters. And it's like, I'm to the point where I wonder if that, because I see it so often in this reckless, aggressive dive bomb descent, that is that necessary? Is it possible to build a controlled, because I mean, I am in my mind fucking surgical. And I spent a lot of time, watched a lot of videos, read a lot of books, and I'm fairly proud of like at my size, my mobility, stability, and control, like able to, because I never feel sore from like a real joint position coming out of a squat. Yeah. Like where I see these guys and it's like they don't know if they're gonna see their kid's next birthday when they start to squat. Like, and for me, it's like my descent speed is the total opposite of yours because I'm going for that one. Right. And to me, it's any potential rebound I get. If I rebound from a bad position, see you later.
That's
right?
Your ligaments rebounding.
Exactly.
That's not strength.
Yeah, that's me waking up like 4 hours later, like what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
But ascent speed, I think we share a really similar thought process. So for me in building, because you do it more so to build, you know, the metabolic conditioning for the most part. I mean, there are heavy components to it, but in a CrossFit workout, you're looking more like, let's fucking motor. Let's get this party started. So our ascent speeds, I think, are probably with the same intent. Yours being at a sub-maximal weight for higher volume is going to be objectively quicker than mine. But I mean, my coach put it like such a fine point on it where it's like in training, especially if you're trying to squat more weight, the idea of the force generation sort of equation. If force is mass times acceleration, and this is, I mean, I squat, I take an empty bar off the rack and squat it like it's 700 pounds.
Yeah.
So when I get to 700 pounds, I've moving with enough force due to acceleration that I can not only lift the weight, but overcome the weight. Cause I think that's a big, speed is such a component of strength that people like overlook, that where it's like, they just think about weight and just getting through it, grinding it out. Where it's like, you want to be able to own that. And the only way to do that is, I mean, say you're 650 pounds squat, you're trying to get to 7. You try and move that 650 like it's 700. So then when 700 is on the back, you're used to generating that enough force where you might not overcome it in like a triumphant way. It might be a grinder, but it's because you laid that framework of lifting submaximal loads with the intent and hopefully the objective parameters. Like someone could look at that and be like, okay, that 650 is moving fast. He's ready for 7 builds, that kind of thing. So that for me is like one of my biggest talking points on squatting is tempo. As yeah. way, I mean, and this could spill over. Tempo is huge in hypertrophy and strength and endurance and stuff like that. But for me, that's something I feel a lot on when squatting is speed, because I think it's so haphazard. People just like...
It gets forgotten
yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And I 100% agree with you. And I think even in CrossFit, it does get forgotten at higher percentages, right? Mm. CrossFitters, a lot of times they have the blinders on. They think, okay, rep versus no rep. Did I hit the standards? Yeah. Is this a complete rep?
Yeah.
And they forget, you know, everything that has to happen in between there yeah. for progress,
yeah.
right? And that's why this is more of a, from my Olympic weightlifting side of things, is fuck, dude, the more I could squat... the more I can front squat. The
yeah.
more I can front squat,
oh, yeah,
the more I can
sure.
clean, right? So I want to obviously be as strong as I can. I don't know if anyone does this with, you know, the intentions of being less strong.
Yeah, than, yeah, that would be an interesting
potential.
Way of going about
yeah,
working
but,
out.
But that's something that I've seen makes a huge difference, is that acceleration, right? When you hit the hole, how fast can you stand up?
Yeah.
You look at some of these Olympians when they're weightlifting,
yeah.
they'll catch that clean and they'll be... it'll look like it's in fast motion,
yeah.
like that you sped
it's
up
terrifying.
The film, how fast they stand it up. And that's, you know, that's what I want to emulate when I'm squatting.
But it's funny to me that you mentioned, like, you know, who squats to not get stronger.
Yeah.
I see it a fair bit, and it's something I have to internally fight against, where there's a difference between building strength and just doing shitty reps. Like, I mean, it's a bit of an aside and kind of off topic, but how often do you see the sacrifice of form and like more of a trajectory set towards perhaps a questionable, let's call it questionable lift, in the hopes of building a faster time or a greater poundage on a bar?
Yeah, too often.
I look at it from two ways, right? Like half of it, if it's competition, right? It's what
yeah.
you can get, like the flight gate. If I can get away with it,
yeah.
win, you know, go home to the supermodel wife, get a cool UGG contract, wear cool boots and get a 4-game suspension.
Well, fuck.
Fuck, if you got to play the game, win the fucking game, right? So,
right.
I mean, to me, there's a certain amount of like, it goes back and forth between hinges on like, kind of, honor a little bit,
right.
like, you know,
integrity.
Right? Would you rather take second place, but know that everyone knows that your squat was like, dude, that was fucking money.
Yeah.
And this guy was like squeaking by on like a favorable 2-1 call kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I see that a lot when it comes, I mean, not a lot, and I'm not going to put anyone down, but it happens. And I'm guilty of myself at heavier weights where you're not really sure. It's like,
it's always going to break down a little bit.
Exactly.
Right? But that's when it falls back to your training. How much integrity do you train with that
yeah.
you're able to maintain as, you know, as close to perfect technique as possible when it does break down?
Yeah. No,
right?
For sure.
So if you're not training with integrity at lower percentages, shit's going to hit the fan
exactly.
when you get to those higher percentages.
Yeah, no, I agree totally.
And that's something you see a lot in CrossFit, is efficiency wins CrossFit. So if someone's not moving well,
yeah.
a lot of times they're not going to do well.
Yeah.
But there is, like you said, that give and take. If you're in competition, you're pushing yourself past the point
yeah.
which you've ever trained.
Mm.
So sometimes some weird shit's going to happen.
Yeah. You can't out-grit bad technique.
Yeah.
I don't think. It's similar in power. It's the same in powerlifting. It's just the guys at the top, the guys who are sitting at the head table are the same guys every day. And that's not a coincidence, right?
Exactly.
They're dialed in.
There's
showing up. They're getting stronger because they can, in their continuum of their training, stay healthy to get strong. I mean, it's outlast.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, we make the joke that you guys are the Hunger Games, but I think we're just drawn out over long, where you guys got the fucking grenades and knives. It's like, we're just slowly chipping. It's just erosion. It's just water
yeah.
against the beach.
Yeah.
And who can fucking hang on long enough to get, I mean, granted there's genetics and all that, but I think a lot of it's just, it's longevity play.
Yeah.
If you want to be around, then it's like, I mean, what, the average like starter is like 4 years in the NFL. Fuck, flash in the pan powerlifters, man. I mean, I can't talk. I've only been in this a year.
Yeah.
Right. Like competitively. But I mean, I feel like we've got the skill set and the tools and the know-how to be at it for a while. But it's like, you see these guys overnight come out of the woodwork, blow up a world record, and then totally implode.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you got to sort of, what are you in it for?
Yeah.
Right. Which I think is a common point that all of these come back to. Why are you squatting? Why are you deadlifting? Why are you working out? Period.
Yeah. These are sports where there's no overnight sensation.
Right? Yeah.
If you're not putting the hours in, if you're not grinding away, if you're not doing it well,
you're
certainly not going to last long and you'll probably never meet your potential if you're not doing those things.
Yeah. I mean, it hits you back with, I mean, they're not contact sports, but I mean, I know guys who are in worse positions from sort of not sloppy, but like more carefree, reckless style of play, let's call it, than guys who, you know, are reckless football players or reckless hockey players or wrestlers or anything like that. Yeah. Weight is extremely unforgiving.
Oh, absolutely. Fuck you, Isaac Newton.
Exactly. I think on that, I think we covered a lot.
We did cover a lot today.
So, I mean, just to recap, sort of the common misconception with the NASM squat, sort of like basic cueing patterns and progression, the importance of strength from a longevity standpoint, some morphology stuff, like how your hips are set, who squats where, and then the contrast, high bar or overhead squat versus low bar squatting, heeled shoes, flat shoes, cueing, breathing, foot position, shoulder mobility, stability. I mean, there's a lot and this is
a lot of things.
I mean, this is granular detail, but this is the stuff that makes a difference. Like,
absolutely.
You're going into the open, high expectations. I'm flying out in a couple of weeks, and it's, if you're going to heed advice from someone about squatting, take it from, consider the source, right? Like, we've done the book learning and we can put it into action. So I think you need to at some point major in the minor.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're dealing at high speeds, if you're dealing with high weight, that's going to be the difference between one and two, or the difference between, you know, the podium place and never squatting again. So I think really, really trying to take some of this to heart and sort of start internalizing some of these cues, some of these ideas into your own squatting, I think is going to be really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the amount of things that are at stake, the amount of working parts here. Anything to close off on?
I mean, we definitely touched on a lot today. I'm sure there's a ton that we haven't touched on. So if you guys have any comments, feedback, questions,
We should definitely do a Q&A
for us.
We should do another Q&A soon. Yeah. I've had some people hit me up about that. Yeah. So if you have any specific questions to the squat, whether it be overhead or more CrossFit Olympic lifting style for Jordan or low bar powerlifting for me, leave it in the comment section. Lundy, Lunderjack Productions, make sure you check them out.
Yes, thank you, man.
Yeah, appreciate it. Like, subscribe.
Yeah, share it with all
Instagram.
Your friends.
No love on the Instagram.
Yeah, show some love on Instagram.
Seriously. I mean, well, the videos on Instagram I think are good because what we talk about here is it's conceptual. It's more or less theoretical. You're not seeing it in real time, which you don't have to see our faces. Good for you.
That's fine.
But I think the Instagram videos that we've been dishing out are good. So pass those around. Like, share, subscribe. Until next time.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys.
We'll catch you later.
See you.